Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, this whole UBS Credit Suisse deal, are you sure this is not as bad as 2008?
Yeah, I think I am sure of that right this moment. In the eye of this hurricane, I can probably say that there are going to be other storms that occur. But Credit Suisse, Signature Bank, Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic Bank, these are all institutions that have had widely known issues. They are issues that are distinct in some ways, but common in others. And the good news is that the largest institutions do not have the exact same complexities that these smaller ones do. And they seem to be in the larger institutions seem to be in pretty good shape. They've got a lot of money on hand. They've got a lot of liquidity, and they are not all suffering from the same malaise or disease that has infected these smaller to mid-sized banks.
I know you've compared the situation to a driver who sees an accident up ahead and suddenly slams on the brakes, and that a lot of money, because of the pandemic and other reasons, went into these dicey investments. But I guess what bugs me is that people investing in dicey investments, the consequences seem to affect the lives of people who don't invest in dicey investments. That doesn't seem fair.
Well, I mean, some of them, let's think about this. The people who invested in Silicon Valley Bank or Signature Bank or even Credit Suisse, they're getting wiped out. They really are. I mean, Credit Suisse, the equity people, the stockholders are getting some money, but, you know, it's a fraction of what they thought they were going to get a week and a half ago. The risky bondholders in Credit Suisse are also getting wiped out, which is a little weird nuance of the financial system that doesn't affect most of us. The investors in Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, they're done. The managements, they're out. So in some respects, that's what should happen. The thing that is different in this situation is that we are seeing regulators come to the rescue of the depositors. Now, you might take a harsh view on this. You might say, hey, if you've got more than $250,000, you should know better and have your money divvied up among different institutions.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair question to ask, sure. But if you are a small business, and maybe even not so small, it really does ask a lot of a small business person, or, you know, a small tech company, a small healthcare company, to be responsible for looking into the balance sheet of the bank with which they're doing business. I think that's sort of, it is asking quite a bit. So the question is then, is the system actually running the right way? Should FDIC coverage be increased? Should we have different levels based on the type of account you have? Those are the questions that are going to be asked in the aftermath of this period.
Are we up against a generational phenomenon, which I've brought up before, and I know you've poo-pooed it, but I'll try it again. At some point, the baby boomers have to start taking required distributions from their IRAs, and a lot of them are in that situation now, and I think it's going to they're going to be more and more. Does that have an effect?
What do you mean in terms of, like, effect on what? I guess I'm wondering what they ask,
well, you know,
what the question is. Is it important?
Taking money out of the system.
Well, so there are some people that are going to be taking money out of the system and spending the money. So
yeah,
that's kind of good for the economy. And there are other people who are taking money out of the system and don't need it and are reinvesting their money. So, you know, the tax has to get paid that on the assets that have not yet been taxed. That's one thing. And so that's what required minimum distributions do. You have to pay the tax that's due. No, I don't actually think that that's going to impact this moment. I think that as people take money out of their retirement accounts, the thing that is most important from an individual level is to understand you will have to take money out of your retirement accounts if those assets have not yet been taxed, and that you may want to do that prior to the moment you're forced to do it. Because right now we have some legislation that is extending the time when you have to take minimum required distributions, and that's to age 75. Well, maybe I want to start taking that money out before age 75. Maybe I want to take that money out out when I know my tax bracket is lower. Maybe it's really smart from a planning perspective to take the money out from age 62 to 70, and that way I'll live on that money and actually maximize my Social Security benefit at age 70. So it presents a lot of interesting planning questions. These are the kinds of questions I answer on my podcast all the time, which is, you know, sometimes it's smart to defer that money, but often it's really smart to take the money out and pay the tax today when tax rates are so low.
And finally, keeping our eyes on the prize here, is any of this having an effect on inflation? Are we seeing an effect? And can you tell me when we'll be finally out of the woods?
Well, I mean, as of last Tuesday, when we got the consumer price index from the government, we found that inflation was still high. We have a 6% annualized pace of inflation. And I think that puts the Fed really in a tough bind this week. So they start their meeting tomorrow. They conclude it Wednesday. And I think that prices remain high. I mean, it is nice to see that crude oil prices are down pretty dramatically right now. So if you look at the price of crude, it's sort of in this lovely area of like the 60s. We haven't been in the 60s for quite some time for crude oil. So maybe the price of gas is going to go down. The price of food is still high. The price of shelter is still high. And the Fed is most likely going to be actually raising interest rates again by a quarter of a percentage point when they conclude that meeting. I mean, a lot can happen in 2.5 days. So who knows? But I do think that that's the most likely path.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
My pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Will sandwiches kill you? Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, last week in the Wall Street Journal, I saw an article that begins, "Americans' favorite lunch is a heart bomb of salt, preservatives, and sugar." And you're the first guy I thought of. So I know you saw the article. What did you think about it?
You know, it's actually true. The cardiologist that they referenced in there basically said that, you know, the standard deli sandwich is he described it as a heart bomb. And it's because most deli sandwiches contain a lot of processed meats, processed cheeses and whatnot. And so they're high in sodium and high in saturated fats and high in calories. And so it's really, you know, all the things wrong with what we eat. But yet sandwiches have become, well, they have always been incredibly popular because they're so convenient. And I think as we've gotten, you know, busier and busier and busier in society, a sandwich is a very portable way to carry your lunch with you or get lunch. And I mean, even if you think about it, look at the explosion in the number of, you know, fast food sandwich chains that have come up over the past, you know, 10 to 15 years. It's unbelievable, the competition in that space. So clearly we love sandwiches.
Yeah. Now, I thought the best part of the article was that it went through the various components of the typical American sandwich. It didn't find a lot to like in any of them, but there are healthier substitutes. So let's go. What are the worst offenders of the typical sandwich?
Well, I think largely the processed meats are a big problem because of the way they're made and what they contain. They're just so high in saturated fats and preservatives, and preservatives are usually rich with sodium. And plus, they put a lot of sodium in it to enhance the flavor. So the processed meats are really bad. Plus, you know, usually the serving sizes are very large, and they're usually served on white bread, which, you know, immediately turns to sugar when it hits your palates. And then that causes your, you know, glucose levels to spike, and insulin follows. So, I mean, I'll be honest, I love sandwiches. But I think one thing I would say is I make all my own sandwiches. I never, I mean, never buy a sandwich because, you know, if you make your own sandwich, you know what's going into it.
Yeah.
And you can really put in really nice, healthy ingredients. And I think that's what the key thing is. I don't think the notion that sandwiches in and of themselves are unhealthy, because frankly, they're not. It's just how it's made and what's in it that really makes a difference. And it really can be, you know, a portable meal.
And the various toppings, including mustard, according to the article, we're just a vehicle for extra salt.
Yeah, I saw that. And I have to say, like, in the article, they actually said, oh, mayo's not that bad. But I don't use mayo because it's just fat. But and I do use mustard. But I also use other things. I use a lot of hot sauces and things like that. And, you know, I do think we need to watch our salt. But I think if you're careful with the other ingredients you're putting in there, then mustard isn't such a bad choice. Because it's essentially calorie-less, but yet and doesn't have any fat.
So there are substitutes. So instead of the processed meat, they recommend just fresh turkey or fresh chicken. You can also put various tomato, lettuce, all that stuff is good. And I was surprised that switching out the bread can make a big difference. If you just substitute whole wheat for the white bread, that also improves your chances of surviving lunch.
You know, actually, I read another article this week about something called the Harvard Diet, which I had never heard of before. The Harvard Diet is a diet that really tells you about how to prepare your plate. And they say, you know, half the plate should be fruits and vegetables, a quarter of the plate should be healthy grains, and a quarter of the plate should be a healthy protein. And I thought, wow, that would be a good guideline for how to create a sandwich as well. The one thing I'll say that was interesting when I was thinking about this also is that when you go to the sandwich shops, oftentimes, I think it's actually required by law, they'll tell you the number of calories in a sandwich.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we eat, it's far more complicated than just the number of calories. And I don't think most people really understand. They don't show you the number of grams of saturated fat. They don't show you the number of grams of sodium. They don't show you a lot of other things. They just tell you the total number of calories. And, you know, you can have a low calorie sandwich that is in fact quite unhealthy, whereas you could have a higher calorie sandwich that is in fact very healthy. And so, you know, it's more complicated than just looking up at a fast food menu and seeing, you know, a 6-inch sandwich has X number of calories and therefore it must be healthy.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. It's time for Crime and Punishment with Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And this first case takes us back to 2018, a woman who was struck and killed by a random bullet. What happened here and what happened to the perpetrator?
It was a Wednesday afternoon in September of 2018, and the victim in this case was working at the front desk at a chiropractor's office. It was a terribly tragic case. A bullet came through the window and hit her and killed her. And the shooter was a 17-year-old who was in a gang-related confrontation and shot at another person, didn't hit him. And one of the errant bullets went and killed this woman. It was a very big story. At the time, he was initially charged with first-degree murder. And ultimately, the prosecutor's office offered him a plea agreement to second-degree murder and to second-degree unlawful possession of a firearm.
Before we go on, what was it that motivated him to fire that gun?
So what was explained in court was that there was an older male who made a reference to his own gang tattoo, and the defendant was in a vehicle and believed that it was a gang back and forth. His defense said that he thought that he was going to get shot, but the difficulty is the other person in the other vehicle, that older male, didn't display a gun, didn't clearly make a threat with a gun. And so it was the defendant's action to shoot at him that ultimately made the difference here.
And so he just fires at this guy. He misses it, and it just kills this poor woman who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That's exactly it. And what's unique about this case is it shows many nuances in state law and why judges ultimately have the authority to determine what is the appropriate sentence here. So this is what you call an auto adult case. So because he was 17 when he was charged with first degree and then later second degree murder, people who are 16 or 17 by state law are auto adult cases, which means that it's automatically filed into superior court. Now the defendant is 21 years old. In October, he pleaded to second degree murder and unlawful possession of a firearm in the second degree. Now, another interesting element here is that even when cases are handled in superior court, when someone is 17, a juvenile at the time when it happened, superior court judges still can sentence the defendant to lower time than what they might normally get. it's up to the court to hear the totality of the circumstances.
So what did the judge take into consideration in sentencing this person?
So the defense asked for 10 years, and they talked about his traumatic childhood and his PTSD and other factors, and ultimately said that a child's brain is still developing, which it is, through your early 20s, and said that the court must consider those factors as mitigating circumstances for why it would be appropriate to give him 10 years, which would mean with the 4 years roughly that he's already served, then that would be about 6 years, not including any time off for good behavior. What Senior Deputy Dan Carew for our office argued is for a mid-range sentence for 21 and a half years, saying that, you know, there have been a lot of people that have been blamed for this outcome, the teen's parents, the school district. But what Dan argued for our office is that this now 21-year-old has not taken responsibility. What the judge said on Friday was that children are different than adults, but ultimately that the prosecutor's office had acknowledged that already when the charge was changed from first degree to second degree. What the judge determined on Friday after looking at the totality of this case was that he said the defendant was preparing for this for years and knew the lethality of his violence. This defendant, who's now 21, had been in multiple prior shootings. And what the judge said is that he believed that defendant had lost the adrenaline rush from being in so many gang shootings.
And so he just kept getting more and more extreme, you mean?
Right. And so what the sentence that the judge handed down on Friday was 21 and a half years.
21 what, and a half years. And that should send a message. Isn't that, shouldn't that be part of it? Sending a message to other kids saying, even if you're 16 or 17, if you fire wildly and hit somebody, you're going to go to jail for a long time.
It does certainly show that there are significant consequences. And, you know, part of what Dan Carew, the prosecutor who argued this case, noted was that if the judge had or the court had agreed with what the defense wanted, an overall 10-year sentence, he wouldn't have been given the option to go to programs that the Department of Corrections has to prepare people for their eventual release. Those programs are available to people who are sentenced to more than 20 years. So by asking for 21 and a half years, this defendant has the opportunity to go through services and programs in prison to prepare him for life outside when he eventually will be released.
Okay, so the longer sentence actually guarantees him an education? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the opportunity for programs to prepare him for his release. And so if you're someone who's sentenced to more than 20 years in prison, DOC says, we've got services to help train you for how to handle life once you get out. And that's much better than just saying, hey, you're going to be in for a while and then, you know, good luck on your own.
I guess so. But he'll always be the kid who killed a person by firing a random bullet. How do you get beyond that? And you're telling me he has not shown any remorse either or owned up to it?
Well, the defense said he certainly had. The prosecutor in court on Friday said that before Friday, he had not seen that the defendant had taken responsibility for his own actions. So it's really a difference of interpretation, but it really does show that the court has great discretion to look at the totality of what's happened and determine what an impartial judge thinks is correct.
Now, you've also informed us that your boss, the King County Prosecutor Lisa Mannion, has set up a new division. This is gender-based crimes, and I thought you already had something like that. You already had a special sexual assault unit.
Well, there's the special assault unit and the domestic violence unit. But really what this does is have a division for cases of rape and sexual assault and domestic violence and other crimes that are similar that have some overlap. And the idea of this new division is to have a more focused approach. Bridget Merriman was named as the chair of this new division on Friday. She's somebody who's worked in domestic violence on violent crimes. And I asked her why she wants this job, and here's what she had to say about it.
It's a privilege to walk alongside victims as they go through this process. And these are the cases that have always meant the most to me.
And the big question, I think, is what does this mean for the average person in King County?
It's my hope that by having a new division, we are showing how much we prioritize these cases and prioritize serving these victims. And the other part of the division is finding opportunities to work on prevention.
So I assume gone are the days when we had hundreds of unexamined rape kits?
Yeah, those are separate from us, but those are expected to be completed, I think, this year. And, you know, one of the things that, Bridget talked about was improving the time that it takes for sexual assault cases to get to trial.
Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks, Dave.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. Summer Lucille, owner of the boutique Juicy Body Goddess, gave one high school senior an unexpected surprise. Her boutique in Charlotte, North Carolina, offers up to size 6X. Though Lucille has been in business for more than a decade, she began gaining national attention in 2021 through the joyful videos she shares on TikTok. And TikTok is how Elise Monroe, an 18-year-old high school senior, found Lucille's store. She and her family drove nearly 6 hours for a prom consultation. Lucille shared Monroe's consultation on TikTok.
Disney princess. Woo! It's not bad, but the purple one kind of like, it's cute though. Like, actually, if it tightened up a little bit. So this dress is $700, but it's free. We're giving it to you.
Are you serious?
I got to get my 10% back. And this is a part of it.
She gave her the dress for free. Lucille says there's no rhyme or reason for how she decides which customer to gift. Last month, Lucille was on CBS Mornings and said she wanted to be a voice for the plus size body community.
I wanted to create a space where we're safe, we're welcomed, and we feel good about
what. And celebrated.
And celebrated. And I wanted to create that. It was nowhere, I couldn't go anywhere. And sometimes you got to kick the door open and create it yourself.
Yeah. And now, 18-year-old Elise has her beautiful Disney
princess. What's the name of the
dress.
Boutique again?
The boutique is called Juicy Body Goddess.
Juicy Body Goddess.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. 7:48 now from the Gene Ursula Show, which starts at 9. Here's G. Scott. I spent all my free time in the sunshine over the weekend and didn't see a single basketball game.
Oh.
So I'm relying on you for the update.
Well, let me just tell you where this update's coming from, because I don't want everyone to think, oh, gee, you're such a college basketball fan. I didn't really watch many games over this year. Not many at all. But I did watch those Zags yesterday.
They were exciting to watch.
And they were exciting to watch. It was a little worrisome because TCU has this Miles guy that was just incredible.
Texas Christian University,
for those who don't know. He could not be stopped. And I'm like, yo, I don't know. But my man Mark Few made some adjustments in the second half. He switched the person defending him. They kind of locked him down a little bit. And then that man,
Drew Timmy.
He is a bad man. Ooh, wait. I'm talking about left, right. What you want to do? Off the backboard. Mama here, mama there. But, hey, he was nice. He was the reason for the season. And, of course, he had others as well doing their thing. Shout out to Nolan Hickman, who's a nice, I know that little young man. I'm a Zags fan, and I've never rooted for the Zags before.
Why? Good for you.
Just because it's not really on your radar?
Not really on my radar.
I caught the fever when I worked in Spokane for 5 years. It's nearly impossible to not love Gonzaga basketball when you are in Spokane. It's all people
really
do and talk about in March. And I caught the March Madness fever when I was there. I don't know much about the team now that I'm over here, but I have to say, like, in the years that I covered them, every single year was an adventure, and it was fun. That is the one thing you can say about that team, is no matter what year it is, whether they get to the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight, whatever it is, it's a great program to watch. And Mark Few is a big reason for that.
I don't want to jinx it, because we know that they always get to the Sweet 16, and we know what happens. But what I saw in the second half out of the Zags, sometimes in... I'm always going back to football, but in football, especially in the NFL, you know, you see the teams doing so well in September and doing well in October. You're like, okay, that's cool. But only thing that matters in football, in the NFL, is how well are you doing in January, right? Yeah. Right? Or December and January, because that's towards the end. You need to peak at the right time. I think what I saw out of the Zags in the second half makes me think that is going to propel them to to peaking at the right time.
Because when was the last time they made the Final Four? Or have they ever? I always forget the stats every year. Let me see. Gonzaga, Final Four. I know they've made it to the Sweet 16 eight times now. They returned to the Final Four in 2021, losing in the final round to Baylor. So 2021, they made it to the Final Four. So maybe they can do it
they
again
were,
this year.
Hey, they really looked good. Yeah. I'm like, yo, that second half. It was, like I said, it was the second half. They just really got after it on the defensive end. I thought Mark Few and his substitution patterns was just incredible. I thought players coming off the bench, I thought they played well. It was beautiful to watch.
What was behind all the upsets this year, though? It seemed to be an inordinate number of teams that were upset by the lower seeds.
Yeah, parity is to blame for all of it, right? There's so much parity in college basketball.
Explain that.
The parity side of it is where you just never know. There's a lot of competition in the game, and here's what I truly believe is the reason. In football, follow the money. Mm-hmm. It's the team that's going to win in football is the team that has the most money to recruit. They got the most money for the training. They got the most money for the facilities. They have money for everything. And you need an entire team, which is over 60, 70 athletes on a football team to win. In basketball, you don't need all that.
Mm-hmm.
You need less up to 15. You need a couple guys that's really good, and you need a few other guys that are really good at support, and you need a coach that has to be able to establish offensive continuity, defensive continuity, and this is why you're seeing the Florida Atlantic right now. They're going to the Sweet 16. You saw Purdue get beat over, they got beat by a number 16 seed.
Yeah.
Because right now, the parity, you don't need much money to get out there on that court and get busy.
G. Scott with Ursula at 9 o'clock. Thanks, G.
Zag!
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.